from HanselMinutes.com. It's Hansel Minutes, a weekly discussion with web developer and technologist Scott Hanselman. This is Lawrence Ryan announcing show number 290, recorded live Thursday, September 8th, 2011. Support for Hansel Minutes is provided by Telerik RAD Controls, the most comprehensive suite of components for Windows Forms and ASP.NET web applications. Online at www.telerik.com. In this episode, Scott talks design with Microsoft UX expert Sarah Summers.
Hi, this is Scott Hanselman. This is another episode of Hansel Minutes, and today I am in Nebraska? Are we in Nebraska?
We are. We're
in freaking Lincoln, Nebraska. And I am sitting down with Sarah Summers, who is a user experience expert and evangelist.
Yes, hello.
You work for the Big Blue Monster. You work for Microsoft.
I do. The Death Star.
Why would you do such a thing? You worked in industry as a designer and UX person for many years, I understand, in different, you know, agencies.
Right.
And then you come here. This is where designers come to die, or?
No. These are some of the best people I've ever worked with. So I really am, you know, focused on who I get to work with, and working with really smart people is very important to me. So that's why I'm at Microsoft.
How long have you been at Microsoft?
Almost 3 years.
Okay. Yeah. So I've been here just about 4 years.
Yeah.
So not that long. So what did you do? Were you just a designer always?
Always. Yes. Came out of the womb that way. No. So I went to Purdue and I got a technology degree, and I focused on visual design, UI design, interaction design, and then I ended up doing UX.
Okay. We did a show with Jeremy Kratz, the designer who created my blog, and we talked about his process and the design process. And that got me thinking about design and how coders think about it. Like, from our perspective, as in our ignorance, I think it'd be fair to say, we see a lot of pencil drawing and a lot of, you know, you guys, I'm going to separate us now. I'm afraid to, forgive me, I'm going to chop us in half. There's designers and then there's developers. I see you guys doing a lot of whiteboarding and a lot of pencils and a lot of balsamic and a lot of, you know, onion skinning and all this kind of stuff, and A-B testing, and then things pop out. But you're using terms like designer, UI designer, UX designer. This is all different, but we don't think of it. We, the coders, don't think of it as different. Can you break it down for me, the taxonomy of design?
Sure. So I think when you have, let's say, visual design, that's really the sort of the skinning of the buttons, doing the color selection, testing the, you know, the different colors together, making sure everything looks harmonious. And then UI design is really taking that user interface and making it understandable, and, you know, placing things, whether you use a grid or, you know, you go out and test against, what else is out there with your users. That's really the user interface focus, is really just organizing the pieces of the application, mm-hmm. In a usable way. Mm-hmm. And then user experience design, I think specifically focuses on the user and the purpose and the meaning and the value of what you're making, all centered around the user and, their tasks that they're trying to, accomplish.
So like the user's workflow and how they move through their workflow and they move through their day and how the design affects that?
Right. So it's, you know, one part, science and psychology, and the other part is, you know, design and organization.
So I think that developers sometimes think that we live in a world of data and hard numbers and things either compile or they don't. And in the design world, it feels like, and this is from our perspective, that what you guys do is very subjective. And, you know, it kind of looks nice. It kind of doesn't look nice. But are there hard numbers that are like based in like psychology and how humans think about things and how humans' eyes move that can really be pointed to and say, no, this is a good design for these reasons rooted in the lizard part of your brain?
Absolutely.
Or are you guys just telling us stuff and we just have to believe you?
No. Yeah, it's really there. So a lot of times you can test and see it. And so what I try to do with developers is take them out to do user testing and research with me. And so when you're sitting down in, you know, someone's office and you're watching them work, you have that aha moment, mm-hmm. where you can really see, the difference between like something that isn't as well laid out and something that, you know, has been really thoroughly researched and thought through. And absolutely, there's lots of great psychology, lizard brain stuff that we utilize to proof out what we're doing.
When we look at blogs about design, when we as developers see things, like we're all watching, I think you don't work for the Windows organization, but you and I are both learning about the next version of Windows by reading the same blog post that the public is.
That's right.
Right. You're not involved in that at all. And neither am I. I don't know anyone over there. I noticed that they had a blog post recently about redesigning Explorer and putting in things about the ribbon control, and people either love the ribbon or they hate the ribbon. And there's a lot of just initial knee-jerk reaction. I call it that someone moved my cheese, right? We've gone and we've moved everyone's cheese. We're moving buttons around. And that got me thinking about design and how things sort of feel stale versus things that we're comfortable with. How can you say that something is a good design if everyone hates it?
Right. Well, you know, what people don't realize is, you know, some people hate the ribbon. Some people love it. But what the ribbon enabled everyone to do is increase their productivity. So they may be grumbling about the ribbon, but everyone's better and faster at what they're doing. All the while, we added, over 200 additional features, all baked into the ribbon. So you can actually do more. So yeah, I think the ribbon always had some controversy. And of course, when Sanofsky put that blog post out where we added it to Explorer, it, mm-hmm. you know, it makes sense because what we're now trying to do is say, well, you know, the browser can be a consumptive experience where we're just going out and we're looking at stuff, reading things, or it can be a creation experience where we're going to, you know, expand, pull the ribbon down and do work in browser.
You know, that's really interesting that you bring that up. I kind of thought I came up with this on my own, but you've actually echoed words back to me that I've said in my head. When I was talking to someone about the iPad, and they said, well, you know, can I do some work on this? I think it was like a guy on a plane. He's like, well, can I do work on this? And I was like, well, I mean, you can, but I said, there's consumption. I said, this is just such a wonderful device for truly consuming. But in every instance on the iPad, when you're trying to produce, you're kind of fighting against it. You're fighting against the multitasking. You're fighting against the keyboard. You know, it's kind of there, but it's really about consumption. And then if you flip the axis and you start really focusing on producing, the user experience has to be completely different.
That's right.
Yeah. And I'm going to be doing this talk on mobile, and people were saying, well, when should I have a native app? And when should I have a mobile app? And when should I have a mobile website? And that got me thinking about, mobile websites are great for consuming and native apps are better for production.
Right.
Yeah. Have you spent much time looking at like how things like HTML5 versus Flash versus Silverlight versus native apps can, and their various pros and cons can enable a good experience for production versus a good experience for consumption?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, you know, when we really just had like Flash and Silverlight to work with, I mean, those were powerful, incredible tools to allow users to really produce great things. So, you know, the same thing with HTML5. I mean, you know, that blend of all of those things are going to really allow people to make great things for, you know, not just consumption, but, you know, allow people to create things.
It's so immature though. Like the example I always point to on the iPhone is the Twitter mobile client, the actual app is very responsive and very quick. But the HTML5 version of the same thing, if you visit twitter.com on a mobile, it's just awful. It's stuttery and it's a mess. And I just think to myself, it must be because it's early.
Right.
It's early.
Right. And when we used to dial up, and use modems, like that was incredibly slow too. And then we had to, you know, figure it out.
When you are prescribing a design, are you thinking about the tech or are you thinking about the experience? And then you like leave, like when does that stop? You see what I'm saying? Like you might say there'll be a grid, there'll be a tree, but you haven't necessarily said, and it will be a plug-in.
Oh, right. So when do you start thinking about the visual implementation?
Yeah. And okay. is it your job? Like you go and design a whole thing and you do A/B testing and you say, yes, and there's going to be this tree on the left here. And the developer says, well, I could use Flash, I could use Serverlight, or I could use HTML to get the same thing. And you have to then decide, well, there's the initial startup of the plugin, but once it starts up, Serverlight's faster, but HTML5 is more portable.
Oh, yeah. I think you want to be part of those conversations in behalf of the user. But, you know, I've always tried to make sure that everybody gets to be in the room listening to, you know, these conversations, talking to clients and making those decisions throughout. Like, I'm all about collaboration and making sure everybody gets to work together and make decisions. So you're not just, as a designer, you're not just like slapping down something or throwing something over the fence to the developer, like, here, figure it out.
Well, yeah, but that's, I'll push a little bit. That's warm and fuzzy, but isn't there a bright line where you feel a designer should dictate implementation versus when you should stop and say, well, here's what it should look like. Here's how, when you click, it slides open, da 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 da. Here's the complete animation that I've done in my prototyping tool, and I want it done in HTML5. Or do you leave that ultimate implementation up to the developer?
Oh, no. I mean, if there's some better way that the developer knows that I don't know about, like, mm-hmm. yeah, absolutely. Show me, teach me, because I want to make sure, you know, they're learning from me. I'm learning from them. And no, if they've got a, you know, a better sort of implementation technology, then yeah, let's do that.
Mm. Okay.
Yeah.
What are you implementing most of your, like how far do you go? Do you make animations? Do you make, what is the delivery product that you as an interactive designer would give someone? Like if we were making a Twitter application.
Sure. I'd want to deliver as interactive of a working prototype as possible. So everybody can feel the transitions and really get the true essence of what you've made. So you can have those conversations where you're talking about the same thing and doing less hand waving to describe
shared
what
vision.
You mean. Yeah.
What do you usually do that kind of stuff in? Just whatever you can find. I know that most designers, if I understand correctly, start in Photoshop. Like literally, that's just where you live.
Yeah, you do a lot of work in Photoshop, but I use Expression Blend primarily, especially Sketchflow, to get across those ideas. And of course, with a Sketchflow, you get the sketchy styles. Mm. So people understand that this is a concept and it's not the final thing. And they're comfortable using it and giving feedback, which you can do all in Sketchflow.
Mm-hmm. Like I saw in your talk earlier today, you had what looked like you'd drawn on a napkin or maybe drawn on a piece of paper, a phone and then the interface that was kind of a panorama behind the phone. Would you go and design something like that in Sketchflow and then the developer would move around within your penciled design to get a feel of how things move?
Absolutely. If I want to do something really quick, I'll, you know, sketch some stuff out, and, you know, snap a picture, scan it in, and then just, you know, put the interactions right on top of it and send it out. So you can at least get the idea out there. I mean, it's amazing what you can do with a half an hour. You know, just sketch something and get the idea out.
It's amazing what developers can do with a half an hour too. We can waste a lot of time. One of the things that was really interesting about your talk is that you kept saying that, well, you can do this in a half an hour, you can do that in an hour. I mean, it didn't seem to me like you were advocating really heavy upfront design. Your design process seemed very kind of agile and very iterative. And you were saying even, what was it that you called? It wasn't a poor man's A-B testing, but you were basically saying people aren't doing A-B testing. They perceive it to be a big deal and expensive and a lot of time. So what were some of the techniques that you had for doing A-B testing on the cheap?
Oh, sure. So, I mean, if you just want to even, you know, walk over to a different department in your office and have somebody, you know, have somebody in accounting test out your idea, your concept. I mean, you don't need a lot of time or budget. You know, once you walk through your idea three times with different people, you're going to know exactly what you need to do.
Mm-hmm. And then you bring in the formal testing, like at that point, right?
Oh, you can. Or, I mean, honestly, you know, you can really kind of go about it that way and still make a great product. I mean, you can do formal testing.
Sure.
But, you know, for all the people out there that don't have the budget, to do that, I think you can still make a fantastic product just by testing with people around you.
This episode of Hansel Minutes is brought to you by Careers 2.0. Careers 2.0 is a new service by our friends at Stack Overflow. You're probably all familiar with Stack Overflow, the online Q&A resource dedicated specifically to programmers and programming-related topics. Well, the team at Stack Overflow created Careers 2.0 to provide you with access to great jobs and introduce you to a bunch of great companies that you might consider working for, even if you're not currently looking for a job. Think of Careers 2.0 as a programmer profile. It gives you a platform to show that you're awesome by featuring your proudest contributions to Stack Overflow, GitHub, SourceForge, Bitbucket, anything programming related. You can even add your favorite programming books from Amazon.com. Profiles on Careers 2.0 are free. They're easy to get started, especially by importing your LinkedIn profile. However, there's one catch. Profiles on Careers 2.0 are invite only. They did this to keep out the spam and have a high-quality environment. Fortunately for you, as a Hansel Minutes listener, I've got your back. Head on over to careers.stackoverflow.com/HM to accept your invitation today. Once again, that's careers.stackoverflow.com/HM. I hope you like it. Might you not find yourself self-selecting like like-minded people? Like you're in the same company, like you said, like there's, it's an attractive idea to pop down to accounting and ask, you know, whoever to check out, take a look at your design. But how important is it to go and find like a target audience? Like if you're making a website for, well, you showed the website Gilt, which is a high-end fashion, mostly women and now moving into men. Surely they're not going to drop down into the developer pit and go and ask them what they think. They're going to go and find women in that demographic and then do the testing.
Right. Well, I mean, for a complicated sort of product or idea where you're not the target audience, like, mm-hmm. you know, if you're designing something for tweens, you're going to need some tweens. Absolutely.
Okay.
But if you're just trying to, you know, figure out whether like an interaction works or if, you know,
okay, confirm your intuition.
Log in here and tell me, you know, I'm going to observe somebody, just log into the site and let's see how it feels. Mm-hmm. I mean, you can really just, get that idea just by, popping over to, you know, account management and just having somebody play with it.
Surprising how few times I've seen that done. You know what I mean? Like I've seen people go all the way to implementation before they get that kind of feedback. At my last company, we would take a giant piece of butcher paper. And we would actually paste it up on the cubes in like near the bathroom or in the kitchen, and we'd hang markers from it on a string.
Exactly. And I think that's great too. You just want outside feedback. And a lot of times people can see what you can't see because you're so, you know, absorbed by it, or, you know, we can all get myopic. So, I mean, some of the simplest things, you know, can go on a sticky note and, you know, get put up on the butcher block, and you're like, oh, yes,
right,
that's a great idea.
I was too close to the problem.
Yeah.
One of the other things that has been striking me recently as I redesigned my blog, and of course, like as I mentioned, we talked to the designer, was that no one told me that my blog looked horrifically old. And it was almost like, one time I was in a meeting, and I think I had like a booger hanging out of my nose, and no one would say anything until after. And I was like, oh my goodness, you guys let me sit in that meeting for an hour with a booger in my nose? It's like people let me have a nasty looking blog for 2 years. And then one of the folks that reads my blog said, well, it didn't look old 3 years ago.
Right.
But it started looking old 2 years ago. Why does that happen? Why does a blog that looked so fresh and so clean so many years ago suddenly look old? It didn't change.
Right. Well, styles change, and I, you know, styles change for everything. I mean, fashion, art, everything. Everything is constantly kind of moving forward, and we're all, as, you know, humans, we're all used to that. So when we see things that we've seen a million times before, or maybe don't have that new cool font or, whatever it may be, then it starts to look old. So I think constantly sort of keeping your site fresh, or, you know, at least pay attention to what everybody else is doing. So, you know, also when your stuff is kind of looking a little tired.
Yeah. I was looking at my iPad recently thinking it looked kind of old. And I was like, really? This thing just came out a couple of years ago. And I'm feeling like it needs a refresh.
Right.
Some skinning.
Yes.
It's interesting, though, because they've committed to a look. They really have set themselves down to a look. It'll be interesting to see what they can do. And it makes me worried a little bit about Metro, because I'm watching the Metroization of everything at Microsoft. It's just kind of happening organically. I think people outside might think that there's some boss at the top who's demanding that we all use this font and that. But it's just kind of things that are natural for Metro are moving that way. I mean, parts of MSDN have become that way. We've seen the phone. You know, presumably the next version of the operating system will have some Metro. That seems like a big bet.
It's a huge bet, but I think it's a really clever one, because Metro's actually really genius at being so clean and so simple. And what's nice and new and not tired about it is that it isn't so heavy-handed. I look at, you know, a lot of the sort of heavy gradient, heavy drop shadow stuff. And, mm-hmm. and that seems a little overdone. If it's a button, it's a button, and it doesn't need to be so overstated about it. So I think Metro is a great bet because it's really clean and simple, and it's, easy to understand because, you know, we used sort of the idea of like the simple, traffic or subway mm-hmm. sort of,
Oh yeah,
iconography yeah. and right. and messaging to convey the same thing without being so heavy-handed
yeah,
about it.
Yeah, that's interesting. I'd never put that together. That the kind of the New York subway map, flat, clean fonts. The kind of Helvetica. Like you've probably seen the Helvetica documentary. Have you seen the movie?
Exactly. Of course.
Yeah, and it's just there's just something about the curves of the you know good black text on a white background with bright but not overly bright colors just is classic.
Exactly. Yeah. Nice, clean, and classic.
It'll be interesting to see how far we can take Metro in the sense of what does it look like in 4 or 5 years? Is it going to start to get some garish accenting of some kind? Or are we going to be able to flex it and move it around and make a real application? Like I'm trying to envision Microsoft Word and Metro and like what would that look like without taking away the good things like the ribbon? And what right. does it add other than a coat of paint?
Right. Well, it can be a coat of paint, but I think anytime you add extra lace or extra fancy to it, over time, you know, that gets removed and you go back to the basic good thing.
Doesn't it feel like we're moving towards the way that Star Trek did all their colors? I mean, you remember in the Star Trek panels, it was just lines and basic colors. There were no drop shadows or fake buttons that looked like they were popping out of the screen. I mean, everything that they were working on were just matte, flat colors.
Right. And I think that, you know, that style of the time, the sort of 50s and 60s sort of mid-century design where it is really clean and the colors are really, you know, bold. That's, you know, we're returning to that for a reason. Architecture is returning to that. And, you know, of course, you know, postmodern architecture is dead where we did that over-exaggeration, that over emblematic stuff. So yeah, I think everybody's kind of moving back to like simple, clean.
Is it a cyclical thing? I mean, are we going to get back into crazy Roman looking serif type stuff? Or are we, like, I'm trying to understand, like I'm imagining the timeline kind of circling back on itself. And I'm wondering, are we converging onto some shared thinking around design and colors and font and type? Or is this just part of an ongoing, you know, cyclical thing that's moving forward? Like, are we, what's the word? You know, are we coming to a point or are we just kind of repeating ourselves over and over? And we'll be right back to Times New Roman in a couple of years.
You know, we could be, but it's also a reflection of sort of the psychology of, you know, current state of the world, that type of thing. I mean, so for example, when postmodern started popping up,
And maybe you could define postmodernism just to make sure that the listener may not be familiar.
Sure. So postmodern architecture was that really sort of exaggerated, big, and then distorted, right? So take some modern design and then add like a couple gigantic overstated Roman columns to the front of it. And there you have it.
Okay.
And so the response to that, was because we all kind of felt lied to. The clean sort of classic design, you know, wasn't really the way the world was working then. So we distorted it. And so my favorite example is the sort of Talking Heads video where he's got this gigantic suit. Remember
the
big
whole Zoot suit?
Suit?
Like, is he David Bowie's space kind of thing?
Right.
It's like 1940s right. and 2040 at the
exactly.
same time.
So it's a statement about overstatement. And so now I think we've since left that because we want to return to that sort of clean, like, no, I want it to be what it really says it is. I want things to feel, like they're supposed to feel when you're interacting with them.
Someone said something, I saw something go by on Twitter a couple of hours ago, and I'm going to get the quote wrong, but it was something along the lines of that boiling something down to its essential elements can never be a mistake.
Right. Like, yeah.
Maybe they were quoting you in one of your talks.
Oh, no, I think that's, yes, that's a famous quote. I can't remember. Yes.
But it's just one of those ideas that getting down to the basics, it's almost like we have to, it's funny. My mom says this about my kids, that children can either grow up, like straight up in the air, or grow out. You can get tall, you can get fat, but you can't do both.
Right.
So you expand, and then you contract and get taller. And you expand and contract. And the same thing happens in design, you know? We gild a bunch of things, we put in drop shadows, we add a bunch, and then we tear it apart, and then we base it, get it down to its essentials. And then we do the same thing again. So, you know, remember trees. Trees were one of those things that were abused in designs, tree views.
Right.
You know, oh, we got a problem on the web. Let's make a giant tree view. It'll be, you know, 60 levels deep, and they'll have a plus and a minus, and it'll represent a tree. And we'll stick it on the left side, and it'll solve all of our navigation problems.
Right.
And then we shove the entire web into a tree, and it doesn't work out, and then we rip it apart, and we come up with new things like breadcrumbs and new thinking.
Right, exactly.
Around design. Up and out, up and out.
Right. And I think that's what it needs, because we're all learning this stuff. And so, yeah, we had to put trees on things and then realize that they didn't work and then break them out and make them more simple and mm-hmm. easier to use. And yeah, it's great to see, things grow and change like that. I wouldn't be interested in our field if we didn't get to really push the envelope and move forward.
Mm-hmm. There's an older Silverlight guy, he used to work for Microsoft, now he doesn't, have Scott Barnes, who says that one of the things he likes and hates about Metro is that it means that anyone can make a good-looking application. Like, if you simply follow the rules, you can at least, not being a designer, have a passable-looking
right.
application. I mean, do you think that Metro is one of those design tenets that, for the most part, you can have a decent-looking application as long as you follow the rules?
If you follow the rules, yes. But I think that's what the design eye and understanding that design thinking behind Metro helps you do. But you still need a designer to really help you implement that correctly. I mean, there's a whole bunch of, you know, things that are right there in the Metro style guide. But you know, people miss them, you know, because they're so, used to capitalizing everything or, you know, and it's just like, wow, like, pop that down and it'll look so much better. And then when you show, you know, when you show devs how to do it, they're like, oh, that's great.
Yeah. I don't know, but that's the one thing, the whole, let's make everything lowercase. I'm still not quite sold on that one, but it's funny. I don't see Metro in everything, but I see Metro like things like The Economist magazine. Like, if you read The Economist and you look at the way their design has moved over the years, it's extremely minimalist. You know, it's almost formulaic, which is one of the things that Metro has been both praised on and accused of.
Sure.
It's being formulaic.
Right. Well, and I think, you know, a lot of great websites out there definitely take the grid approach. You know, you put a grid on it and organize it in a way so you can, you know, really flow through the information and your eyes can kind of relax because they're not bombarded. But yeah, I think there are times where you want to break the grid too. And I think that's Metro allows you to do that as well.
Break the rules altogether.
Well, you know, break the grid with, let's say that, you know, the great, you know, kind of full screen images and stuff like that. So it's not so hardwired that it has to be boring. That's right. It's not hardwired to be boring. I think it's hardwired to be really simple and, you know, incredibly easy to use.
Yeah. if you look at apps that people are talking about being really nice in design, like Flipboard, you know, I bet you if you change the font of Flipboard to, you know, what is it called? Is it Sego it's pronounced?
Oh, yeah.
If you changed Flipboard, which is a magazine application for the iPad, if you changed its fonts to Sego, it'd be a Metro application. I mean, it's just because all there is typography, white space, and good photography.
Right.
And you've advocated for people having good photography. Like, nothing can spice up a blog or a magazine or a design than great photography.
No, people want to look at interesting things. A few great pieces of photography and some really nice, like, clean fonts, you're halfway there.
And that is kind of the essentials that I think we're moving towards. I mean, Metro or not, it is what it is. The idea that white space that is meaningful, typography and fonts that are clean, which is now being enabled by web fonts, which is great, having more and more fonts that are free.
Oh, absolutely.
Google's got that great catalog of all these free, patent-free and copyright-free fonts that you can use, and good photography. And you can put together a nice application of any kind.
Oh, absolutely. I think About Me, that's a great example too.
Yeah, About.me.
Yeah. You can just, you know, it's really just a great big picture of you or what you like to do with your information. And, you know, it's really pretty. They allow you to, you know, change some of the things and the fonts and everything, but it still ends up looking cool.
It's bizarre that so much, it's funny that you bring up About.me. You can go to about.me/shanselman and you can see, and all it is it's like your about page.
Yeah.
They want to be your about page. And it's a giant photograph of you as the background, but it's done in such a way that, like, even though it sounds like listening to it on a podcast, that how could that be a business? How could that actually work? It actually does.
Yeah. Sometimes you don't need this, like, grandiose, like, complicated idea. It's really just a neat, simple idea that, you know, takes off.
Well, like Tumblr is half what it is, which is tiny blogging, but it's half great design. I mean, they really embraced designers and got designers paid for their,
right,
for their designs as well.
Yeah, and they've rolled out with that great design right away.
Yeah.
So they led with that, and it worked really well for them.
It's interesting. Even sites that you wouldn't think of being deep in design, like Stack Overflow, led with good design. Like, I don't think there's the gaming aspect of Stack Overflow. There's the crowd theory and all that economics of Stack Overflow. But if it hadn't been well designed and well thought out from the beginning, and all of the subsequent sites that are being designed around the Stack Exchange family, it couldn't have succeeded, right? An ugly Stack Overflow would be ignored just as an ugly Tumblr would.
Oh, that's right. Yeah. No, I mean, that was the keys to the city for them, in a sense.
What are some, in conclusion, what are some blogs, like three or four blogs or books that you would recommend that non-designer listeners might enjoy taking a look at to learn more about the design world?
Sure. I think About Face by Alan Cooper is the Bible for interaction design and great design. I really like the Luke Warblowski form design book. I think that's incredibly great. I mean, if you have to do something with a lot of information or a lot of fields, he tells you exactly how to make that, like, the absolute best experience you can.
A lot of fields, like text boxes over data?
Exactly. And then, let's see. That's another.
What about blogs that you would read? Like, do you, like, read, like, the usual suspects, like A List Apart and things like that?
Oh, yeah. A List Apart is fantastic. I read it all the time. Mm-hmm. I mean, obviously, I'm a huge TechCrunch fan. And then, let's see. UX Mag is good, and Smashing Mag is really great too. They broke out and have a UX section now, and they also, you know, they really accommodate for, you know, developers too. They do a lot of, like, you know, let's try CSS for, you know, like this stuff, and, you know, they do a lot of web design stuff too.
Great. Well, send me those links and we'll make sure that we put them up on the show notes for folks to visit.
And, we'll do.
Thank you so much, Sarah Summers, for chatting with me today.
Hey, thanks for having me.
This has been another episode of Hansel Minutes, and we'll see you again next week.